through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
All right, it is the MLB draft happening right now. Mariners have several new players, so let's learn everything we need to know about these guys with 710sports.com. Brandon Gustafson joining us now on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Hey, Brandon, how are you?
Doing great. They just wrapped up their fourth round pick here like 2 minutes before I got the call. So
I'm expecting you to know everything you need, like possible about this person, by the way. I feel like 2 minutes was enough.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's start with their first round pick. Jerry DePoto going with a high school player for the first time in his tenure, going with catcher and outfielder Harry Ford. Tell us what we need to know.
Yeah, this guy is a freak athlete. I mean, it's really easy to see why a team would fall in love with this guy and just dream on him. Big-time speed, using the 2080 scale, where 50 is average. He's a 60-grade runner. He's got a big-time arm, and he can really just let it loose behind the plate when he wants to. The athleticism, it just jumps off the table. And I was on the Zoom call with Scott Hunter, who is their director of amateur scouting, and he's kind of the guy that leads the charge with their drafts. And it sounds like he's just a really high character guy with some awesome personality traits. One of the cooler things that Hunter said about Harry Ford was that Hunter and DePoto watched him take batting practice, and this guy goes up there with a weighted donut like Nelson Cruz and Edgar Martinez used to do, and he's hitting balls to right field and right center field, and there's this jacked up 200-pound high school kid just doing all these things that the pros do, and they just fell in love with him. And I think that going with a high school kid like Ford, who has all this upside, even though we're probably not going to see him for longer than we would with most of these guys that they have drafted in the last few years, it's easy to see that they think that the farm system's in a really good spot. They have a lot of college guys that they've drafted over the last 2 years, some international signings that are all really close. And Jerry DePoto and his staff, they love to talk about those waves of talent, and they're building up those really future waves that are going to be here a few years from now.
Brandon, what's so intriguing about Harry Ford, and we'll get into the explosion that he has at the plate, and you kind of highlighted that, but the fact that this is a player that is listed as a catcher slash outfielder, and when you hear them talk about him, it's very unique from anything that I have ever heard. Have you heard a player be described as a five-tool player and possibly a catcher?
Yeah, it's not super common. I mean, this is a guy who really, if we're looking at just projectables, this is a guy who could probably hit in the high 200s, hit 25-plus home runs, and even steal 20-plus bags for you while playing behind the plate, at least early on in his career. That's not normal. It's not normal to have somebody that can go behind the plate and call a game and run the show and go out and hit a few home runs that's also going to go out there and potentially steal a bag or two for you in a game. So it's really cool to see that they're already kind of open to the idea that maybe he catches, maybe they can move him around infield, outfield. He could probably play all three outfield spots. They mentioned second base as an option, even though they listed him as a catcher and outfielder. So there's a lot of clay that they can mold with Harry Ford. So it's going to be really cool to see what they're able to do with him going forward. And I'm really excited to be able to watch him as he finally makes his pro debut.
You know, Brandon, it's exciting about these prospects and especially a guy like him who has all these unique skill sets. But one of the hardest things as well is, you know, you go from the NFL, the NBA, and other, you know, professional sports, is you get to see these guys right away. And that's not the case with Major League Baseball. There's a maturation process that has to go into it. Harry Ford's obviously very, very young. But what is the timetable like for anybody that just wants to hear this for the first time? What are the steps that he's going to go on? Where will he be from day one?
That's going to be really interesting to see. It's one thing that I know some people are concerned about early on when you draft a high school kid is whether or not they're even going to be signed in the first place, because they have the option to go to college if the signing bonus and all that doesn't line up with what they're looking for. Doesn't sound like that's going to be an issue based on some of the stuff I've read. It sounds like he's going to pass up on Georgia Tech and come up to Seattle and play for the Mariners and the organization. So where he winds up and how early that is, it's hard to tell, and part of the issue with that is we don't have as many minor league teams with these clubs as we used to. They cut that back starting last year, so whereas some guys early on would have started in a short season ball, which used to be up here where I live, up in Everett. That's not the case anymore. So whether or not he's going to be somebody who can start right away in the late summer like we used to see, it remains to be seen. It might be something where he's a guy that starts off his pro career in the Arizona Fall League or playing in a winter league or something like that. But I know that as soon as we do find out where he's going to be making his eventual pro debut, whether that is this year or that's early next year, there's going to be a ton of eyeballs on this guy, especially because he's the highest drafted high school guy that DePoto and his staff have made since 2016.
I want to get back to your earlier point about that they're picking a high school player with their first and second pick, and I do want to hear about Edwin, is indicative of their belief in the farm system. Can you just, I know you talked about it, can we go back to that though and just kind of what the Mariners choosing high schoolers with their first two picks tells you about either the club's belief in their direction or about the direction they're going in?
I think it's a mix of both. I think that it's this mix where they're very comfortable with who they have right now, and they know that a lot of those guys are very close. They're really happy with the progress that a lot of these picks have made and seeing these guys shoot up prospect lists and things like that. But they're building to the future as well. Jerry DePoto loves to talk about sustained success. So obviously, from our perspective, we're looking at maybe 2023 as like the latest year in terms of how far ahead we're looking for. But these are guys that are maybe 2024, 2025, 2026 guys. And the best teams are able to build up farm systems for that far in the future. A lot of these guys that we look at their farm system rankings are guys that are going to be here probably by the end of next year, or maybe early 2023 at the earliest. But these are guys that are going to be here way down the line, but they're very tooled up prospects. These are really, really supreme athletes. And I know that one of the quotes that stuck out from when DePoto talked to you guys, not last Friday, but the Friday before, was they wanted to go with the high upside athleticism. They thought this was a really, really good draft for that. And that was kind of when it really stuck to me that a high school kid in the first round or in their first few picks isn't off the table. Whereas the last few years, they pretty much avoided that as much as they could with those early picks. So it just shows that they're in a good place with this farm system. A lot of these guys that we've been talking about and hearing about are going to be here before we know it. And then this is that next wave from a few years on now.
The voice that you're listening to is 710sports.com's own Brandon Gustafson, who's been doing some excellent work, you know, leading up to this and wrote a bunch of articles highlighting what the Mariners might be looking to do during the draft. And you nailed it with Harry Ford being one of those guys that you highlighted. And you went through some other pitchers as well and want to get to these guys, their third round pick and their fourth round pick, Michael Morales. And also you look at Bryce Miller, these two guys, their third and fourth round selections. Are any of these guys that you highlighted, noticed? What can you tell us about them?
Yeah, so they're pretty different guys. And Michael Morales, he's another high school kid. They went high school route with their first three picks. He's more of a command and feel guy from the right side. He's 6'2", he's about 200 pounds. He's committed to Vanderbilt, which has been like the premier spot for pitchers over the last few years in the college ranks. Looks like he's got some pretty good movement and feel for that fastball. It's probably in the low 90s right now, and he's got a pretty good curveball as well, and the changeup works out well for him against left-handed hitters as well. Good athlete. He's another guy like their first two picks who is a really good athlete, and he's on the mound. He's probably a little bit of a safer floor than some of the other high school arms that you'd probably get at this stage of the draft. You might be looking at a guy who has one great tool, whether that's a breaking ball or a fastball. That's not really the case with him. He's a command guy. And I know that some people might think like, oh, command guy in the third round, high school rank, that's not the most exciting pick. But the Mariners have had a lot of success with these guys that come in there with plus command in terms of having their stuff tick up. George Kirby is a prime example of that. Their first round pick back in 2019. He was a low to mid 90s guy coming out of Elon University. And I see tape of him throwing 99 to 101 now just because of the work he's put in and the work that the staff has done with him as well. Taylor Dollard was their fifth round pick last year. He was another command guy out of the college ranks, and his stuff's ticked up. So with Morales, yeah, he's more of that command guy who's going to pound the strike zone, whereas Bryce Miller, he's got the big-time fastball, and he was the first college pitcher, or the college player that they've taken in this draft. He was a reliever early on at Texas A&M, and he transitioned into a starter. He's a four-pitch guy with the fastball and slider leading the way, and he has a average curveball, average changeup that can both probably tick up as he hones in his control and his mechanics a little bit. So he has a pretty high ceiling, whereas I think that Michael Morales has a little bit of a higher floor.
Brandon, I know we brought you on to highlight some of the draft picks, but you know, just listening to you talk about some of the development that the Mariners have done with these pitchers, it's been really interesting to look at what has happened with Jerry Dipoto selecting three pitchers in the first round, Logan Gilbert, George Kirby, and then Emerson Hancock. And the report was on all these guys is we don't know if they're ace level stuff, but they're going to be pretty good pitchers at this level. We see Logan Gilbert, how he's developing as of right now. What does it say about the job that they have done with all three of those guys?
Yeah, they've done an awesome job with their pitching. We're seeing it finally up at the MLB level with Logan Gilbert. We've seen the stuff tick up from him since he was originally drafted back in 2018. I mean, that last outing against the Yankees was just dominant. I mean, seeing him touch 99 and then go back to an absolutely nasty breaking ball to get Aaron Judge to strike out was one of the highlights of the year for me, just watching the team in terms of seeing that stuff. Because you're right, when we were looking at those three guys, a lot of people were saying, okay, those are guys that are probably number two, three, or four pitchers in a rotation. Well, we're seeing Gilbert, he's flashing ace-level stuff. And George Kirby isn't too far behind him. And as I noted, that stuff's ticked up big time since he was drafted. And Emerson Hancock, people forget, he was originally in play for the number one overall pick in last year's draft. And then the play of some other guys pushed him down just a little bit, and the Mariners were able to nab him at number six. And another guy, Jake, that you didn't mention, who I know they're really high on, I'm really high on, is Brandon Williamson. He's a big lefty that they drafted back in 2019 after taking George Kirby. And he's already up at Double A. He's moving along faster than George Kirby is. It just goes to show how much they really like him. So they've done an awesome job drafting and developing their starting pitchers. And I think that that's one of the things that really can speed up a rebuild and make you a competitive team, is having young, controllable pitchers that are able to rise up quickly and just get things done at the MLB level. So seeing Logan Gilbert's success and knowing that you have those three guys in particular coming up here pretty soon, it's really exciting if you're a Mariners fan.
Now, do you think that the Mariners will potentially have to sacrifice one of those arms to get starting pitchers or add someone this year? Or do you think it's something where they say, you know what, we're focused on 2022 and 23. We believe in these guys, and we're not willing to sacrifice Kirby or Hancock for a starting pitcher now?
Yeah, that's tough, because that's one of the things that's interesting when you look at farm system rankings, is how much a team values their guys versus how much a team values the other team's farm system. And while we can all dream on what George Kirby and Emerson Hancock and Brandon Williamson can do at the MLB level, and we don't know what they can do because we haven't seen that yet, the guys that theoretically you'd be trading for are known commodities. So it just kind of depends on the return. But with those three guys in particular, it's easy to see how much the organization values them. So I think it has to be getting quite the return in order to move on from any of those three guys. But that's another thing where the depth of this farm system with some of those other arms, like a Juan Zen and Sam Carlson, as he gets healthier, Isaiah Campbell, he just had a minor surgery, but if he gets up there and running again, those are guys that maybe as they rise up, those could be the trade chips rather than parting with one of those top arms. But it's a good conversation to have, and it shows just how good of a job the Mariners have done. And I know that people are maybe not as thrilled that it doesn't seem like they're going to make a super, super push into a postseason run in 2021 like we thought, but they lost an entire year of development last year with no minor league baseball. So the job that they've done is top notch. And I think that Jerry and his crew definitely deserve to be here 2022 and beyond.
He is Brandon Gustafson. If you are not following him on Twitter, what are you doing? Please do so immediately at the B Gustafson, not to be confused with another B Gustafson. He is the B Gustafson. He's got pictures of his new puppy Maverick on there. That's always a treat. He's also got really awesome coverage of the Mariners at 710sports.com. Thanks so much, Brandon.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Take care.
All right, it is time for Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
With Jake and Stacy.
You live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
Jake, first down to you. ESPN continuing with their positional ranking series today. It's quarterbacks.
Oh, baby.
Where did Russell Wilson land?
Well, Russell Wilson, in their overall ranking, actually landed at number 4. The highest ranking that he received was number 2, and the lowest ranking that he received, get this, 9. So a lot of range between
9?
The lowest ranking he got was 9. So
by whoops.
I don't know. I don't know who that is, but I would love to find out.
David Carr.
If he had a chance, it wasn't
Pete Prisco for sure.
Maybe, but this wasn't a report or rankings done by media members. This was NFL executives, NFL coaches, and scouts. So I think that there could be a wide range there. But I think one of
wide
the things
range
that
of haters
there to me, I think stands out more than anything else, the belief that Russell Wilson is going to bounce back this year in a way. And we're talking about a year where he had 40 touchdowns last year. Talking about a year where in the first half of the season, he is the runaway MVP, the number one quarterback in the league. And then obviously, as we know, the wheels fall off. But I think that the belief is that he is going to get back to being a consistent player, being a guy that is going to have his interception ratio down even more and be more of what he has been in his entire career. He's got 10 seasons of a body of work here that is pretty outstanding. But one of the things that stood out to me from this article is this quote right here. He'll have easier throws to make and won't have to be the hero as much. I think the main thing is he just has to get rid of the ball faster. If he does that, he should have a good year. And I think that's the whole point of the design of this offense. The transition of this offense is to take some of that burden off of Russell Wilson in terms of having to play hero ball. And what I mean by that is extending plays all the time, having to take deep shots all the time, and having to be that big play difference maker all the time by getting those deep explosive plays down the field. Now you can create explosive plays by throwing the ball horizontally and through the screen game and a variety of different ways. And that's going to be the task of Shane Waldron. And I think that this offense is going to fit him very, very well. And you see Russell Wilson get back on track. And when you talk about this highest ranking of number 2, I think we're going to be looking more along that line next year as you see a very, very good resurgent performance from Russell Wilson.
Second down. Stacy, what is the latest on Seahawks training camp, and who will you be watching first?
Okay, a way for me to sneak in a little bit of news here from the Seahawks. So if you are interested in attending Seahawks training camp, you have to register through the team's website, seahawks.com/training camp, and this begins 10 a.m. on Wednesday, this Wednesday, July 14th, seahawks.com/training camp, registration on first come, first serve. And if you're 15 or younger listening to us right now, first of all, stay in school. Work your hardest.
There we go.
Live out your dreams. And secondly, you have to be accompanied by an adult. So you can't go by yourself.
Wow.
I know. The second part of that question is who I'll be watching. Look, this is actually the toughest thing to watch in training camp. The stars of training camp are always the running backs, always the tight ends, always the wide receivers, because there's little to no contact allowed. The most important pieces of this team, to me, are going to be on either side of the line of scrimmage. The interior of the offensive line is what I'm going to be watching, and I'm also going to be watching the development of the young edge rushers, starting with Darrell Taylor.
Third down. Jake, circling back to that quarterback ranking list, in your opinion, is Matthew Stafford better than Dak Prescott?
At this stage of the game, no. I don't think he's better than Dak Prescott. And what Dak has been able to do, people really sleep on Dak and what he has accomplished in his career. I mean, in 2019, what he did was outstanding. Threw for almost 5,000 yards, 30 touchdowns, 11 interceptions, and was really the sole reason why that team had any success whatsoever. They were 8-8, but I mean, everything was on Dak's shoulders. It was clear as day, and he made it work. And I think he would have had a massive 2020 season had it not been for that horrific leg injury that he sustained. Mm-hmm. For Matt Stafford, all of a sudden, he's jumping up the charts. All of a sudden, Matt Stafford is, you know, the number six quarterback or the number five quarterback. Some people even have him in top five, in their top fives now. Why? Because now he's in the Rams system. Now Sean McVay is going to get all the goods out of Matt Stafford. And I think Stafford is an incredibly talented passer. But when you've been in the league as long as he's been, you kind of get the book written on you. And I know he's been with the Detroit Lions, but I think Stafford is a very talented quarterback that can be better in a different system. But in terms of what Dak Prescott has to do for his team and the Dallas Cowboys, I think Dak is the better quarterback at this stage, and quite frankly, I don't think it's close.
Fourth down. Earlier this morning, Jake Brock Heward told Paul Gallant that he encourages people to prepare for early bumps in the road for the Seahawks on offense this season. Do you agree or disagree?
I think it's a natural thing to expect, and I think it's smart of Brock Heward to tell that to fans and everybody else. When you have a first-time play caller who, I mean, he's never called plays, right? So there naturally is going to be a learning curve there, and you're going to play against two pretty good organizations in the Colts and in the Tennessee Titans. So I could easily see that being the case. However, I'm going to disagree here with Brock Heward, because the reason why I disagree is that I think that this is a unique first-time play caller in the sense of he knows exactly who he is. In Shane Waldron, he knows exactly what he wants to run. Whereas if you go back and reference Brian Schottenheimer, his first time here in Seattle in 2018, there were so many factors as to why they went 0-2 and why that was such a bumpy road for their offense. One, they had an injury to Doug Baldwin, first and foremost, the first couple weeks of the season. You're relying on Brandon Marshall to essentially be your number one receiver at the time. And then with that being the case, Brian Schottenheimer wanted to open up the offense, be a passing offense, when that's not who he has been as an offensive coordinator, nor is it the reason why Pete Carroll brought him there to begin with. So the whole thing the first 2 weeks was just weird. Out of sorts. It was weird. Shane Waldron knows who he is, knows what he wants to accomplish, and so therefore I think it's going to be a smoother transition than what people might expect for that very reason. Although Shane Waldron, being a first-time play caller, he knows exactly who he is, exactly the system that he wants to run, and I think it'll be a little bit smoother than what people anticipate. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be smooth in terms of wins, but I think the offense will perform seamlessly.
All right, some updates for Tuesday's All-Star Game. Plus, the world found out Kyle Raleigh's nickname thanks to a tweet from Jared Kelnick. We'll tell you what it is next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacy.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
This hour of Jake and Stacy is brought to you by the Pro Club. It's The Timeline, reading you the top stories you're going to see on your own Twitter timelines. In case you missed anything, we'll tell you all the biggest stories from the day. We have plenty to get to when it comes to the Seahawks, to the Mariners. But before we do any of that, there is a viral story going around. If you see Shohei Ohtani trending, it's not just because he is the star of all stars in the All-Star game, and it is really Ohtani's year. Ohtani dominated the first half of MLB. That is the story of the first half of the season. It's also because he is the subject of a topic, a conversation Stephen A. Smith was leading on First Take that has come rightfully under fire. Take a listen to what Stephen A. had to say, Cut 7.
And I understand that baseball is an international sport itself in terms of participation. But when you talk about an audience gravitating to the tube or to the ballpark to actually watch you, okay, I don't think it helps that the number one face is a dude that needs an interpreter so you can understand what the hell he's saying in this country. And that's what I'm trying to say.
Now, I'm going to go first to Clinton Yates, who tweeted out, and it is my sentiment perfectly, so I'm just going to borrow it from him. Clinton Yates said, "Reminder, speaking English, not a requirement to be tremendous at anything, never mind being a baseball player." And it certainly isn't. Not only that, but the idea that Ohtani, by not speaking English fluently, and he can speak English, mm-hmm. not fluently, but he can speak English and can speak some Spanish, but chooses to...
Wow, that's right. Okay.
Chooses to That's speak crazy. Through an interpreter, which if I didn't speak a language fluently, I would also choose to do so. So I didn't misrepresent myself. The idea that he's not drawing eyes to the sport, or that he could draw more eyes to the sport or draw more marketing opportunities if he spoke English, is, I think, completely misplaced. And I don't have to give anecdotal evidence for this. This is not how stardom works and how phenoms work and things we haven't seen in decades and decades work. Everyone recognizes greatness in the moment, regardless of whether or not that person speaks English of all languages. But I was at the park on Friday at T-Mobile Park when Ohtani was at the plate. Mariners fan, Angels fan, whatever reason you were there, every pair of eyes was glued to him.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
everyone was watching it.
And I saw that myself. I mean, I have friends that went to the game, and their tweet wasn't about the Mariners. Their tweet was about, hey, I'm at the game, and here's Shohei Ohtani coming up to the plate. I mean, what this guy is doing extends way beyond any language barrier. Now, Stephen A. may have a point in saying that he might not drive as much market as, like, let's say, a Ken Griffey Jr. was back in the day with his smile, his swag, and everything that he brought to the table. But that doesn't mean it's bad for baseball, because who's the face of baseball right now?
Maybe
for Major League Baseball?
Maybe Fernando Tatis.
Is there a face?
Or Shohei Ohtani before anyone else?
I think Shohei Ohtani has been so unbelievably dominant that he is becoming the face of baseball. He's becoming a player that is definitely recognized across all sports, across all planes. And if Shohei Ohtani is able to keep this up again for a second season, he without a doubt is going to be the most recognized baseball player in the country. And it doesn't matter if he has an interpreter or anything whatsoever. That is not going to hold him back from everybody witnessing his greatness and everybody wanting to go to the ballpark to watch this guy be a dominant pitcher and see this guy crush the ball at the plate. That to me is where Stephen A. completely misses the mark. Just because Shohei Ohtani isn't on every single commercial out there or loses out on an opportunity or two because he is not because he needs an interpreter, that does not mean it is bad for baseball whatsoever. And I think Stephen A. Smith is way, way off base with
also,
this.
Also, there's nothing about speaking English that inherently adds to your own greatness or you as a person.
Correct.
Ohtani can speak to some capacity, like three languages.
Absolutely. He can.
I speak one.
And he can do it. If he wants to, he can do enough where he can do commercials for Gatorade. How hard is that? I mean, these are the things that when you talk about Stephen A. and these type of comments, I mean, it's just...
It's bad. It's a bad hot take.
It's bad. It sounds a lot like what we were dealing with here with Kevin Mather on that rotary call. But my goodness, I just think that what Ohtani is doing goes so far and beyond any language barrier. Real recognizes real. And what he's doing is unbelievable. Nothing like this sport has ever seen before. And it's such a bad take. Bad, bad take all the way around.
Someone, 253, texting in, well, he's saying being the face of the league. How does that stop him from being the face of the league? Like, if you're a generational talent that no one's seen since maybe Babe Ruth, why would you not want that person as the face of your league?
And it's also not going to hold you back from getting endorsement deals. I mean, that's the thing is, Mike Trout is a guy that is very, very much to himself. And is the best player in baseball, and people have tried to market him, but he's not a star. He doesn't have a star personality. You watch Shohei Ohtani, you watch him, you actually watch him, not just the highlights, but you actually watch this guy. He's got personality. This guy has something to him, and I think he is tremendous for the game of baseball. Fernando Tatis, guys like that. I mean, I think that there are hope. Obviously, we know Major League Baseball struggles to actually market their own players, but it's not going to be because of Shohei Ohtani's lack of ability to speak English.
Well, and who's a bigger star right now? Mike Trout, who can speak good English. It's his native tongue.
Right.
Or Shohei Ohtani, who chooses not to speak in English when making public appearances. Your language is not the key decider in how popular you are.
No.
Shohei Ohtani is infinitely more popular nationwide than Mike Trout is, even though Trout is probably a better hitter. But Ohtani is just, he is a generational type talent that is popular amongst kids, adults, everybody.
Yeah.
All right. Let me move on to this final story just to end on a little bit of some fun here. Well, it was initially a scary moment. So if you were seeing Joe Ross trending, well, that's because he's a pitcher for the Nationals. His dad saved the life of a Giants fan in the stands. There was a Giants fan who was choking on a hot dog. And Joe Ross's dad, who I guess is a doctor, like a pediatrician or something, performed the Heimlich maneuver on her and saved her life.
Wow.
This is insane.
Not all heroes wear capes.
Truly.
I mean, unbelievable. So that's one of the coolest stories that I've seen. Also, scary moment, and so glad that he was there at the right time, right place.
Now, I also have, we have 30 seconds to sound off on this, but I want to make sure you can do it. Trent Dilfer. If you saw Trent Dilfer trending or Matt Hasselbeck, it's because he tweeted that Matt Hasselbeck was the best quarterback in Seahawks franchise history.
My guy, Trent Dilfer, I love you. Love you to death. We coached on the Elite 11 staff together. He then went back to his tweet and tried to re-clarify and say that, no, Russell Wilson is the best quarterback in franchise history, that Matt Hasselbeck might be the most significant quarterback in franchise history.
A little bit of revisionist history
but
there.
But also, I think that...
What does that even mean?
That didn't even do justice. Still, it doesn't... Your reinterpretation of your tweet, your clarifying tweet, it still doesn't add up there. I mean, Russell Wilson has been pretty significant for the franchise, I would say, in what they've been able to accomplish.
Yikers. We're going to head back to the Mariners because as I outline my biggest concern for the Mariners' second half, specifically the second half of July, Jake's got his as well. So he's going to tell us what it is. And then because we're going to ask nicely, Jake is going to tell us how they can overcome it. That's coming your way next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by the Pro Club. We've been outlining our biggest Mariners concerns and how they can overcome them in this, I don't even want to say second half of the season. I'm looking specifically at the second half of July and the first part of August because they're facing so many wild card contenders that they can really make ground there. But they've also got a lot of improvement to make both offensively and with their starting rotation. So I said that my biggest concern was that the lack of an extension for Jerry Dipoto would mean he was a bit hamstrung at the trade deadline and couldn't make a significant enough move to improve the team. Jake, what is your biggest Mariners concern?
Well, my biggest Mariners concern is sustainability. Can they sustain what they've been able to do over the past month? And the reason why that's a question for me, although I love what they are building and what they are doing, and I love how scrappy this team is, I love the fight that they have and the belief in each other, but they have overcome their circumstances in just about every single way. Injuries, poor run differential, poor performances from two key pitchers from the start of the year, Marco Gonzalez and Justice Sheffield, and one of the toughest schedules in Major League Baseball. So my question is, and I'll throw it to you guys, do you think they can keep it going after the All-Star break to give them a legitimate chance at the wild card spot? Because there are so many things that they have had to overcome along the way just to get to this point.
No, and I think that that's a really like downer way to look at it, glass half empty. But I think that if they are going to make any significant ground in the wild card race, it's going to be because other teams like the ones in front of them, for instance, like Tampa Bay or Oakland, suffer injuries or setbacks. Or it's going to be because they suddenly have a turnaround from someone like Marco Gonzalez, or let's say Sheffield gets back and performs much better, or Dunn gets back and is performing even better than we thought. Like, they're going to need almost like overcompensation from some kind of group to make up for a lack of it elsewhere. I mean, when I look at where they are in OPS the last 30 games, they're so much better than they were in the first part of the year. If you look at year to date, they're like 29th or 30th. If you look at the last 30 days, they're more middle of the road, but almost every team that they're going to be facing is still ahead of them in that, including Houston. They have two series against them in July and August. They're the best offense in the league. I mean, offensively, they are unbelievable, leading in almost every category except for home runs, and they're still near the top of the pack there. So I think that there has been some substantial improvement from this team, specifically the lineup, in the last 30 days through June and into the first part of July. I don't know that it's enough to stay in this race, which is why I need to keep reminding myself that, like, the goal is improvement, not necessarily contention. And that sounds like a bummer, but I do think there is a chance to improve still.
One of the things that I look at as well when we talk about sustainability is I look at not the guys at the top half, like we've talked about with Seager and Mitch Haniger, and now you put J.P. Crawford in that category, Ty France, but the guys that have been your heroes of the day that have come through for you in the bottom half of the lineup, Jake Bowers, Jake Fraley, Shed Long Jr., Dylan Moore at times, right? Luis Torrens, he's been hitting the ball very, very well since he's been back from the AAA level. Can those guys continue to keep playing at the clip that they have over the past month? That, to me, is a big question mark. And Jake Fraley, you know, is a guy that I am really excited about, and I hope he is able to maintain what he has been able to do. His OPS is still really good, but you look at Fraley, his batting average, I mean, he was around 250, 260 pretty securely, and then has kind of gone on a little skid here towards the end of this, before the All-Star break, down to 237. I'm not saying I'm down on him by any stretch, but I'm just saying those are the types of players that are going to make all the difference. Then you add Cal Raleigh to the mix. You add Jared Kelnick coming back. What do those two guys have? What impact can they have in the second half of the season, and can it be positive? These are all questions that I have, and I think are going to be the questions that matter the most when it comes down to this team being able to contribute. And I'll go one step further. If they can keep it close in terms of their playoff contention or being in the hunt for the wild card heading into the trade deadline, I do think that there's some moves that Jerry Dipoto can make and will be afforded to be able to make, Stacey, along with your concerns that you have, how much flexibility or how much leeway is he going to be able to have to make these moves? He can make some small moves like adding Nelson Cruz. I mean, how big would that be to your lineup, adding him as your permanent DH to end the year? Adding a stable arm to your starting rotation that isn't necessarily a top-level elite arm, but a guy that's performing very well. Gibson out of the Texas Rangers is somebody that we've been able to see quite a bit that I think would make a ton of sense, that you wouldn't have to give up a crazy amount to be able to pull off. Those are two moves that I think could help bolster your team if they're able to keep it close towards the trade deadline.
Like about what you're saying with your point, though, is, yeah, sustainability of what you've been able to do is important, but I liked the idea that we've talked so much about, especially wins and extras and in one-run games, being luck, because in baseball, what else do you attribute that to? And I do think that that's a very fair point. And you said it feels like there's something a little more tangible than luck. It's not something you can always rely on, but it feels a little more tangible than luck that they've been able to really kind of stay scrappy and succeed in spite of, like you said, the injuries, poor run differential, poor performances, and then a tough schedule. To succeed outside of all of that takes more than luck, which I think makes Mariners fans a little more hopeful than just thinking like it's a flip of the coin.
Right. And that, to me, is you want to build on that belief. They're going to have to show that they can do that coming out of the gate in the All-Star break. We've seen teams flip the script one way or the other, right? Positive, negatively. And I think it's going to be a big opportunity for the Mariners to show their maturation through this process with some of these young guys that they can continue to keep winning at the rate that they have after the All-Star break. I think that's going to be huge for them as they're moving forward. And you know, Curtis, what do you expect from this group after the All-Star break?
I kind of look at this group right now and more of the same, unless there are some reinforcements added. We're going to see a team that's going to play a lot of close games, and then they're going to get blown out from time to time. And that's just kind of how it's been for Jerry Dipoto's teams here over the last couple of years. I remember 2018, when they had a similar first half. They were actually a better team in the first half that year,
yeah,
but also had a negative run differential. Their run differential still, what, like negative 50? They're only 9 runs better than the Texas Rangers, who are 22 games under 500 right now. So it's so hard for this team it's so hard to predict anything for this team when they are still teetering a very narrow rope right now, where any little slump could really throw this season you know, into the garbage can. But also, if they can get some you know, help, whether it be in the rotation, I would hope that the rotation is a place they look to first, or whether it be a veteran bat, I mean, that could really catapult things and maybe, you know, create some stability that we haven't really seen this entire season.
All right, this hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by the Pro Club. Coming up, Jake is going to make his, I don't want to say debut. I mean, it's really like a one chance only
one
to
shot.
See it.
Network
you get
TV,
one
man.
Shot, never before seen, never seen again. Jake is going to be on American Ninja Warrior. We can't wait to see it. Now, it won't be spoiled for you, but American Ninja Warrior host Akbar Babiabila.
You got to get this down.
Baja
Biamila.
Baja Biamila will stop laughing at me. I will join us in just a couple minutes. I think I could maybe get a spoiler out of him.
No.
I think I could.
He's a pro. He won't do that.
I'll ask him.
Okay.
You
can try.
I could figure it out.
We're going to have some fun with
it. We'll see what happens. Let's come in your way next.